Today is Tuesday, August 28th, 2001. In the fireside room this evening is today's forum. Today's session number is FO 2001-18, and it's titled Outreach to the Poor and Homeless. Let's listen in.
All right, well, welcome. We're here tonight to talk about outreach to the poor and homeless. That's the title. And what we do is we're called a reach team, and our job is connecting with homeless people and creating some stability, and from there helping people getting into permanent housing. And so the four of us are all on a team together. And this is Mark Getches, who used to work here for 5 years as a cook. This is Erica Schneider. She's from Beloit. And this is Chloe Gale, who grew up in Seattle, and we all work together. So we'll start off with some just nuts and bolts stuff, and then we'll say a few things and throw it open for any kind of questions.
Nuts and bolts. Okay. So let's see. Our program has existed for about 5 years in Seattle. It was it's funded through its federal money through the Department of Public Health, the King County Department of Public Health. It actually originally came from a research project that was done for folks who were on the street and addicted. They created a case management program to see if there are some ways that they could help support people moving off the street, and they found a lot of success in that program, so they decided to start our program as a permanent part of the Department of Public Health. Vernon and I both started 5 years ago when our program started, and we now have 7 case managers and 2 nurses who work together as a team. We do outreach to people downtown, and the idea is to really build relationships with people, to engage with them, and build some trust and some rapport, and really, and then help learn about the people that we're working with and what they want, what their needs are. And then we just support them in whatever way we can. One of the things that's interesting about the addiction field is there's not a lot of funding for case management. That has not really existed. A lot of mental health programs have case management built in, but it doesn't really exist. So in the addiction field. So we've ended up doing that for folks that we support, and generally we kind of support them indefinitely or as long as they're interested in having our services, which is a real boon for us that we really get to know people over a long period of time and see a lot of success and growth in their lives. We also have a lot of people who don't change dramatically, and we really work a lot in, you know, appreciating and valuing where people are in their lives and what they can do. I said we work with a lot of folks that are addicted, and our approach is different than a lot of traditional addiction treatment, in that people don't have to stop using. They don't even have to say they want to stop using to get our services. We're not at all contingent on that. So, and sort of the idea behind that is that for people who are on the street, if the first thing they have to do to change their lives is stop using a substance, they may never make that choice. And we believe that people really have a right to having a safe place to be and having support, having food, and hopefully having housing, a place to live. So, often, you know, when people have some of those things, they can change in other ways. So it's kind of an unusual philosophy in the realm that we're in. That's it. That's nuts and bolts.
That's nuts and bolts.
Okay.
Any questions?
Yeah, well, first of all, you said it's a federally funded program, so do they have it in other cities?
They may, not specifically. Our county just has developed this program specifically with the out of the Department of Public Health. that healthcare, we're part of a, in the Department of Public Health, we're part of a network of providers called the Healthcare for the Homeless program, and they're all kinds of providers. They're doctors and nurses and social workers and folks who all kind of go out in the community where people are that are homeless and try to help them. And there is a national healthcare for the homeless organization. There are people around the country that do that. But I think every community decides in their own way how they're gonna serve that community. So our program is, I don't think that there are any exactly like ours that I know of.
And when you say support, what do you mean besides finding housing and medical support?
Mark?
A lot of time it's just visiting with folks, and that we might be the only person in their lives, at least the only healthy person in their lives that they have, and it's just engaging them on the streets, and that's the service that we provide, and we're there. If they would like services, we can help them facilitate that. If it's housing, or it could be possibly treatment. It could be just as simple as getting an ID card or a social security card to receive services. So it can be as simple as those services, or as big as housing or treatment.
We also visit people in jail. We what are the things that we've done? Visited people in jails. I have clients, I go over their house, and this one client I get together and shoot pool with them. We go out and we shoot pool. I mean, for a lot of clients, especially when they're just trying to be sober, you know, they need a diversion from, because all of their friends over the years have been users and drinkers, and we might be the first person that they deal with that isn't addicted and trying to get them back into using and drinking. And so that might involve just, like I said, I used to go with this guy to shoot pool, meeting people for lunch, sitting in the park, just a whole number of things. We take them to DSHS, we sit with them in terms of getting signed up for various government things that they may, some of these people may even be eligible for government funding, but they don't know, you know, they're just out there. And that's one of the things we do. We take them down and we actually sit with them and spend time until they talk to the right people and connect, and then, you know, we can help them get SSI or GAU or something, something to that.
What's
that? Oh, I'm sorry. DSS is just the welfare office. GAU is public assistance. SSI is also public assistance. Supplemental security income, and it's monies, and GAU is $339, SSI is usually $529, I think. So
I'm guessing that you don't work 9 to 5 hours?
We kind of do. Erica?
Okay, well, maybe you got it. I mean, I was just thinking, working with homeless, maybe to identify the folks, you probably have to be out later hours, perhaps, or is that not the case? What would be a normal day, if such a piece exists, for any of you? What's your favorite color?
There's not an average day. Okay. It's whatever. I mean, every day kind of starts out and you have some idea of the structure and it changes, and I'll go out looking for clients and I might not find them, but something else might be there, or I might engage other folks, or somebody that day might want to work on something and I have time to do that. So every day is different. We usually do work Monday through Friday just because that's when other agencies are open. Okay. And that's when you can plug into it. We can get in early and check and get into the shelters early to connect with them early on. And there might be some times when we'll do some odd hours to connect with folks, but Usually we could find people during the day.
So do you have an office where people, once you've contacted them, then they can come and drop in to talk to you, or is what, like, what percentage of your business is actually done out on the street?
Well, I have a different project than everyone, so my project is called Reach 2, and I do a lot of groups and activities at our sobering center, where we have kind of a big cubicle where we all meet and have our files and stuff. What percentage?
Well, the program is, we're like, we call it client-centered, which means we go to the clients. They don't have to come to us in our office at any particular hours. We find them. If they have a payee, which means people who get their SSI checks and then give it to them because for some reason or another the client doesn't feel like they're responsible enough to handle the money, or a doctor says that you need someone to give them, this person, the money, we go there at an agency where there's an agency that works specifically with Native Americans and serves a breakfast, and Native Americans can come there and shower and get coffee in the morning and whatever. We go there, and so we go where the clients are. We really don't expect them, nor do we have hours for them to come and find us. We go and find them, and if we have to meet with them at a certain time, we'll meet them where we think it's easy for them to get to. We'll meet them on this corner or at this agency or whatever at such a time, and then we go where we need to go with them. So that's in the Reach 1 phase, and then when we get to the Reach 2 phase, that's when they come to where we are. And we can explain that phase.
Yeah, I can talk a little more about Erica's position. What we found, because after we'd been doing this work for several years, is that a lot of people were really doing very well and, had gotten sober and were really staying that way. And this was a huge transition in their life, probably one of the most difficult they'd ever done. And suddenly they found themselves with no community, very isolated, living in an apartment and really having a whole sort of new idea of what to do with their day and their time and trying to find ways to support themselves in their sobriety. And so as part of that, we decided that we really needed to concentrate some of our efforts on helping folks build community and create more opportunities for them to socialize with other people and also just have things to do with their time. And so we designated one staff position, which is what Erica does, and she just creates activities for people and does all kinds of great things. We've done, we actually started the program with a camera club where we had individual disposable cameras, and we thought, why don't we just see what happens if we handed a bunch of cameras and see what happens and what people want to do. And we gave out probably 55 cameras, really thinking, we're going to see about 20 cameras, because, a lot of folks on the street, you can't even keep track of your glasses, let alone, it's really hard to track your stuff often on the street, things get taken. And we probably got 50 of those 55 cameras back. People guarded them with their lives. Guys who were not sober for 5 minutes, really. They spent all their time just kind of pretty lost in their, downtown area. They would take their camera and they would come back and they would have like a whole set of photos that were just really incredible. Really pictures of people's lives, and folks came and said they hadn't seen pictures of themselves for 20 years. Like, they hadn't had pictures of themselves since they were a kid. They didn't have pictures of their friends. They didn't have pictures of their community. One guy who actually had an apartment, was doing real well, and was kind of looking for things to do. Mostly he went to AA meetings. He took his camera and went and got on the ferry for the one Saturday. He was walking downtown. He said, I just got on the ferry. And he headed off and did a ferry ride all day and took all these pictures of downtown. And he said it was great. There were all these other tourists taking pictures. And there I was, taking pictures. You know, and he really had this, you know, great, it was this great opportunity for him to do this thing that he never would have done. So the camera club came up together, and people really wanted to keep meeting and talking about their photos. It was not actually initiated by us. We had a lot of clients who wanted to keep coming back and having coffee and share their photos, and we actually developed a show and put up the show in a cafe, which is a great nonprofit cafe in downtown Seattle, and people got to hang their show and have an opening. It was really a wonderful opportunity. So that's one example of what Erica and what folks have been doing there, but they've also gone on trips, and so there's just been a lot of really fun growing kinds of ways, I think, to help people get involved in different ways. For me, it felt like there was a woman that I'd been working with for years and years with her boyfriend on the street who really didn't want to do much to change her life and was pretty happy with it. And when she got a camera, she's hearing impaired. She can hardly hear, and English is not her first language. She's native, and so she often has a really hard time communicating with people and doesn't make a lot of eye contact. She's pretty isolated just in her with her small community on the street, and she got a camera, and she has the most incredible eye. I mean, the photos that she came up with are so whimsical. She has her boyfriend in a red coat standing in front of a tree with red leaves, with a, you know, like she, and they're all kind of taken at an angle, and just really funny. There's a lot of humor in them and a lot of cleverness, and like there was this whole spirit of hers that really came alive through her photography. And to me, that you know, that I hadn't really had an opportunity to see before. So I felt like that kind of, I think we felt like that kind of experience has been really helpful in our program.
You are not volunteers.
No.
No. And you're paid by the federal government.
The money goes to a private nonprofit. So it's through the county, and then they contract with a private nonprofit called Evergreen Treatment Services. That's who we work for.
How many are in there? Are there just the four of you, or do you have more people?
Seven. There's seven case managers, and then there are two nurses also who work with us, one of whom runs a clinic in the mornings from 7 to 9 for folks.
I missed your first comments, and maybe you said this, but what reaches all capital letters, does that stand for something?
No.
No,
it doesn't stand for anything. We had a whole meeting where we tried to make it stand for something.
If you think of something,
yeah.
Let you know.
And then someone just said, well, why does it have to stand for anything? I said,
oh, okay. Except we get questions like that.
Fitz Regis?
Reach.
This is the Regis Hotel right downtown, isn't it?
Yeah.
We
know that.
Very familiar with that hotel.
Yeah, something about, so you seek out new clients and you just walk the streets and say, oh, that's somebody you don't recognize, and then start conversations with them? Is that how you feel we'll get a new client? Or just wait for them to kind of approach you? Or
it has changed. When we first started doing it, we would go to agencies that worked with homeless people, and we would talk to those people, and we'd say, who do you see here that you think is ready to work on getting some permanent housing, you know? And so we would talk, they'd introduce us to people, we'd connect with them, make that connection, and then we'd go from there. And now through a HUD grant, we reach people at this place called the Sobering Center, which is a place that people can come, alcoholics in particular, but people with other issues can come and just sleep over and just kind of sleep it off. They come in, you check their
vitals.
What's it called?
Vitals
and see how much they've been drinking, and then they just lay down and on mats on the floor, and they just sleep and then get up in the morning and leave, no strings attached. And then we're all in the same building, and then from that we see who the frequent flyers are. You know, we see who the people are that have been staying there the most, and then we approach them. And that's kind of where we get our client base from there.
How do you get the funding for housing, or to what kind of permanent housing can you get your clients into?
Well, we don't really have a silver bullet. You know, it's not, we would love one, but there are existing housing, low-income housing around. And then what we do is we plug into those existing places. Like a lot of our clients, it's difficult for them to do what you have to do to connect and go to these places, fill out an application, wait. They don't have phones because they're homeless, so there's no way you can call and say you're on the list and you've moved up to here, you've moved up to there. And so we help them do that. We let them use our phone number. They can call us. But there are existing low-income places throughout Seattle, and there's not enough, of course. But what we do is plug people in into those. So we don't create housing ourselves. We just plug people into existing houses and existing waiting lists. So a lot of these places have waiting lists, and as many as 90% of the people, when their name comes up, they can't find. Whereas with us, they call us and then we go and find these people to make sure that they get into that house.
And then they have enough money themselves to pay whatever the low cost rent is?
If they have an income, SSI, GAU, they take a third of that income. That's what low income housing is. So they make sure they pay a third of that income. If they have no income at all, they pay $25 a month. And hopefully the plan is that at some point they would either become able to work or do what you have to do to become able to get SSI or GAU, and then they can pay a third of their income. And there's, unlike other apartment buildings, you don't have to pay first month's and last month's rent with the low-income apartments. Right from the start, you pay a third of your income, and that's it.
Barbara and I live in San Francisco, and our church is right in the heart of an area where there are a lot of homeless people. And San Francisco kind of handles it by moving them from here to there, and not doing very much for them, really. And we're trying to open our church up, and we're having a very hard time doing it. We've started out by just Sunday morning for 1 hour. We offer free coffee and donuts and a place to sit down, a clean place to sit down and relax for an hour. We provide a temporary storage for their belongings, and we feel at this time we're not really prepared to do any more, but we want to, and don't know how to get the training in order to make that happen. Any suggestions?
Is this my department?
Well, I actually worked with a group in Seattle, in the University District. There was a group of seven churches that provide shelter for homeless youth. And I helped develop training for volunteers up there. And they've worked for years, probably 10, 15 years. And they trade each night. It moves from a different basement, from a different church to a different church. But they're all within 5 blocks of each other, and they coordinate it. So, I mean, I'm thinking there must be something in San Francisco. You know, there must be some...
A public agency?
Some kind of... I think that there must be some church organizations in San Francisco. I certainly know of them in Seattle that provide shelter. The other model that we have in Seattle is there are a lot of self-managed... There's a very strong self-managed shelter community, and I'm actually going to single out George, because George has worked a lot with that organization, Share, and they, I think they probably have 10 or 15 self-managed shelters.
19.
Yeah. In churches and other places where homeless folks organize themselves, and they have someone who's in charge of that space in the evening, so that the church doesn't necessarily have to provide, you know, staff there all the time, but the homeless folks kind of organize their own themselves. They have someone who coordinates it every night and is responsible, and they keep track of who goes through there and that kind of thing. So there are several models. I don't know of a national one. I don't know San Francisco that well.
Well, San Francisco has something for the winter like that, mm-hmm. but people cannot be drinking nor be on drugs. So the street people that live around our church definitely have problems of either mental health, alcoholism, or drugs, so they're not going to get served by any of the shelters that right now that at least we know about.
Mm-hmm. I saw a hand back here. Do you
have
an answer?
Well, that kind of cancels out what I was going to say. There was a Palo Alto project that did congregations for the homeless and had them sleep over, but yes, I know the screening was pretty tight for drugs and, you know.
Well, I know from my dealings with Compass Center, which used to be called Lutheran Compass Center in Seattle, that has been there for years. In my own church, where I'm the pastor at, the thing about working with homeless and most churches, the homeless need is so great, it will eat a church alive.
Yes, that's what we're afraid of.
And just good hearts is simply not enough, you know. And at our church, we serve a meal twice a week. And the homeless population has changed so much that now we get up there, we get a lot of young people. We're on Capitol Hill. So we get a lot of young people. They show up with their dogs. They go in the restroom. They shoot up. You go in afterwards, you find needles and stuff. And that used to didn't be the case. Every now and then there's a fight in there. And you can't have older people who are retired or semi-retired with good hearts, you know, working with that population on a regular basis, because it used to just be, you know, years ago, it was just old guys who were drunks, and that is quite a bit different than what it is now. And so one of the things that Lutheran Compass Center, just Compass Center, one of the things that they push is that churches should combine and work as a group in terms of it, rather than this church doing this, this church doing this, this church maybe skips a week because the volunteer didn't show up, this church, you know, that kind of stuff, hit and miss, is that you try to organize and get a group of churches where you, and really, really figure it out, you know, what you need.
I feel like
we
really need some training in this on how to deal with that population. Mm-hmm. So what you said, they can beat you up.
Just spent the weekend in Seattle from the Midwest, and I was really struck being on Capitol Hill by the number of young people in their 20s asking for money, because I don't see that in where I'm from. It's
where are you from?
Cleveland. It's usually the homeless there are mentally disabled or low income for other reasons, but I was overwhelmed by the number of young people there who may or may not have been homeless. They might have just been asking for money, but why is that?
Easy.
That group up there on Capitol Hill, they're there because they want to be there. They're not homeless because they're made to be homeless. That's how they want to live. That's it.
Is it because of drugs? Drug use?
A lot of it is that, you know, but a lot of it is, it's, we see a lot of drug use, you know, myself, I take care of, I mean, share, we, it's Seattle Housing and Resource Efforts. And that's one thing, you know, we run 10 City up there in Seattle. And that's how we do it, it basically is from church to church to church. You know, because they try to find a church and the church just say, hey, Jesus and God will help these people. We're helping them. And that's what we want to do is share. We want to be the stepping stone for people that want to get off the street. And where they got certain hours that they work, I'm out there at night and I see people as they are. And when I call them, you know, these people are willing to go to bars and they're willing to go to a party to help somebody if they ask for help. You know, which is basically what it takes if you're, like you say, down in San Francisco, you shouldn't do it alone. You should get a hold of other churches and such, other groups. If you look around, you find out there's more people that are willing to help.
You know, something else you could do is, maybe you can talk to us later, and we can come up with a list of places in Seattle, and you can call them and maybe see what they've done. Because I'm just not familiar enough with San Francisco to know what's going on there, you know. And so it's possible that we could come, I mean, share would be, you know, the number for share would be a great start, or Compass Center.
Is that a national
church
or
council? Actually.
Church council.
Is Share national? Or?
No, actually, we started in Seattle about 20 years ago or so, you know, in Seattle Housing Resource Effort, you know, we just, in fact, we started with TED. We went to an auction at Fort Lewis to buy our tents, you know, and the cameras followed us there.
To buy your what? I'm sorry.
Tents.
Tents. We bought army tents to put up initially. And we put it up down by the Kingdome, and the Reach wasn't around yet at that time. You know, but that's all we were showing the people is that you all had your turn. Now it's ours.
Where did you get your money to buy the tents? Did you have?
From the people. You know, and that's basically what it takes, is someone that cares and a lot of honesty. Because when we basically got started buying a motel on Aurora. And a lot of people, when they look at me, they don't see that much honesty, but when I pulled out that big check and said,
another reason why there are so many young people on the streets in Seattle is that, number one, Seattle right now is hip. Mm-hmm. So people want to be there for that. The weather is so mild. So it's easier, you can lay out on the streets longer, you can hang out longer for that. It has access to all these other mild weather places and hip places, Vancouver, California, and, you know, so that kind of thing, that has a lot to do with it as well.
Okay. How does the addiction picture break down with folks you work with? Are we talking, is it a mainly alcoholic or drug using? What kind of drugs? How bleak is the picture?
Well, it's basically everything, but we find that the people we work with the best, I think, and you all can correct me if I'm wrong, which I'm probably not, people who have alcohol issues are a little easier to work with because, number one, if you drink in your apartment, that's not illegal. If you use drugs in your apartment, well, that's illegal. So it's just kind of harder to, to justify keeping someone in a place if they've been using drugs because that's illegal. Secondly, alcoholics are easier to track than people who use drugs. People who use drugs are, you got to be out there hustling all the time. So you don't get into a routine of where you can be easily found, or that kind of thing. And it's also, people who use drugs are just, for lack of a better word, just a lot slicker. And, just in terms of the believability of what they say is just, it's just nil, So it's hard to build up a rapport because for a number of reasons, for fear of, since drugs is illegal, for fear of being turned in, for fear of being caught, for fear of a number of things, a drug addict will tell you anything and that he or she thinks you want to hear. So it's harder in that case to work with people who are strictly doing drugs. Also with younger people, it's harder because they're so mobile. They can go anywhere and their bodies are still working well. And they feel within themselves that they have a lot more potential, and if they want to kick this, they can. Whereas a lot of the people we reach realize that whatever they've been using is taking a toll on them. They may not ever be able to kick it. They're tired of the streets. It's taken so much out of them, and they're ready to be worked with.
Actually, I want to say that right now the folks we work with is limited because we're doing outreach out of the sobering center. That's how our funding is arranged, out of this facility, the sobering center, and it really is for folks who are addicted to alcohol. So we have people that use other drugs as well, but right now, because we have to do outreach there. Originally, when Villan and I started, we could do outreach to anyone, and I still have folks that I work with who mostly used other drugs, not alcohol. And it certainly is a need to work with people using all kinds of things. Right now, we have to kind of work with alcohol mostly. And it's bleak. Okay. Yeah.
Plugging somebody in that's wanting treatment is very, very difficult. And once they get in, the supportive services that they, after they get out, is minimal, if nothing. They could walk out and not have any services. Hit the streets again.
And then just a personal question by the floor. How do you folks cope? I mean, how do you stay sane?
We're not. What do you mean, how do we stay sane?
How do you ground yourself? I mean, I imagine the work has got to be kind of frustrating. I mean, from the bureaucratic side of things, or just, looking at a side of day-to-day reality that a lot of folks just don't deal with. So how do you stay grounded? How do you keep on going into work with an upbeat attitude? Where do you get charged?
I can answer part of it. At least one thing that pops to mind for me is the fact how unique this program is, and that if a certain client is needing a bunch of time, that you're not restrained by that. That you are able to give the time needed, and to meet them where they're at, and that alone is a unique situation. When you check out other social services, which, they're always packed, and the clients the staff person doesn't have time for a client, they're overworked, they have way too much going on, and one of the unique things is that we try to provide enough time for every client.
I think the fact that we have four people here to, you know, with us here in the Reach 2 program is a real charge to see the progression and to see that it can work. You know, that's a real charge for me, even though I'm not involved with Reach too much at all. Although I do, you know, I am a movie critic, and on movie days we help. You know, but just the fact that's working and is a real charge for me too.
Yeah, I would say for myself that part of it is that the work is very inspiring. I mean, I think I get asked that a lot. You know, I've been doing this for 5 years, so, and I've been working with homeless folks for 10, 12 years. And I would say it's as inspiring as it is discouraging. And it definitely can be really discouraging. I have had people die that I really care about, and I've seen very little change in some folks. But I also feel like it's a privilege. You know, it's such a privilege to me to have relationships with people that really have struggled and succeeded and are very strong, very, you know, real survivors and have gone through so much in their life. And for me to have this opportunity to get to know them and for them to share themselves with me is really incredible experience. So that keeps me moving too. Yeah.
And I find it inspirational because I've met very few. I mean, I can count them on one hand of the homeless people that I've encountered that didn't believe in God. You know, I think God, as Lutherans put it, because we're all intellectual and complicated, the three and one and two and four and all that kind of thing. I think that in that way, you know, that, you know, I don't find a lot of homeless people that put it quite that way, but it amazes me. You know, you see these people who've been on the streets, homeless, and they still have a belief in God and an afterlife, and that God is working with them in their life. And I meet people all the time who are, you know, who have regular jobs and good health and not those kind of issues that homeless people have who don't believe in God at all. So in that sense, I find it, I find it inspirational and, you know, that kind of thing. And for me to see people who are struggling, whose lives are such a struggle, and then they can have that belief system, I don't know, it just sort of blows me away. And we all kind of get along for the most part. So it's fun to come into the office and just make jokes and laugh and joke and, you know, kind of support each other in what we're doing, and then we go back out again. It's kind of like being one of those TV detectives without a gun. You know, they just, you know,
the show. That's one way of putting
it. Yeah, those great cop shows, they come in and they talk and then they take off. You know, they're going to people's houses and interviewing. It's kind of like that. It's sort of, I was real impressed with Rockford and that kind of thing.
In my neighborhood, it's changing. There used to be a lot of rooming houses and a couple of residential hotels, probably like the St. Regis. I guess that's what that sounds like. That's what that is. Mm-hmm. But those are being eliminated. And is that contributing to the problem of homelessness? And are those types of facilities, even though they're dumps, are they still needed?
I think this is true over a lot of the country, but in Seattle, it's an incredible problem. In San Francisco, it's an incredible problem. In Seattle, there are no low-income hotels the way they used to be. The whole downtown, the old original part of the city, Pioneer Square, used to be, basically housing for people who worked on the waterfront, for guys who, you know, and for folks who'd retired and were on pension, pensioners and all kinds of old sailors and folks who live down there, and they do not exist. They're all being turned into condos. The entire downtown of Seattle, all the urban development, and it is not, they have not held on to low-income housing. I mean, there are efforts, and especially in the nonprofit housing community, they work very hard to hold on to a few spaces. But our economy is going like this, and our housing is nowhere keeping pace with that. So it absolutely has an impact on what we do. And it's really frightening, because people become homeless for many, many reasons. And there's always this debate about, are folks homeless because they've had mental health problems or addictions or physical problems? A lot of people become homeless. Or is it because they're poor and they just run out of money? And I think the answer is both. You know, it does not take much once you're living one paycheck to one paycheck, or you live in a hotel downtown and it shuts down and there's no alternative. It takes nothing to be on the street. And once you're on the street, you have a whole host of things that you're dealing with all the time. So, absolutely.
Used to be it took a fourth of your income. They'd say a fourth of your income to pay rent. So when they'd ask what your income was for an apartment, if the rent was a fourth of that, that would be one of the things that they felt like, yeah, he could handle living here. Now it's a third, you know. And so it's just kind of, that's just how it has skyrocketed over the.
And how many people pay a third? In Seattle, you cannot get a one-room apartment for under $700. It just doesn't exist.
May I say something here? Mm-hmm. You know, I work with this other group around in Seattle, you know, called Operation Homestead. And a lot of these buildings that were shut down and getting ready to tear down, we went in there with crowbars and moved in with sleeping bags and took over the building to keep them from tearing down. And I did a lot of the cooking. I still do. And you know, I'm a well-known cook around Seattle. And I do cook at a number of churches. I'm Baha'i, by the way. You know, but that's one thing I like about these people, is that they care. And a lot of the other groups around Seattle, they don't. They'll push you into a program, but once you get out of the program, you got nowhere to go. You know, but these people stick with you.
How do you evaluate what you've done? What's your overview? How does that happen?
Through our contract. I'm taking all the contract questions. we have a, through our HUD contract, we have 8 outcome measures that we get measured by every year, and those are improvements in housing, entering treatment, some kind of treatment, access to non-urgent health care, which means most folks who are on the street generally get their health care from the emergency room. So we're trying to connect them with clinics and community providers, so that, because it's to reduce costs, basically. Do you know what the ones are? Actually, basic services. There's a funding one, getting them income and then getting them a payee support management. So we basically have 6 or 8 outcome measures that we measure every year, and so we can see how we're doing, progressing. One of them is retention of folks in the program. Mm-hmm. So.
Did you have a question?
No.
Okay.
And we've actually, when we started, we set those pretty low. none of us had done this before, and we had this contract, and they said, okay, so how many people do you think will access treatment out of 100? And we thought, oh God, 10%, you know, 15. We thought, you know, folks who've been on the street for 20, 30 years, years. I mean, we have people who've been a long time and who've been drinking a long, long time. And we thought, you know, the chances of them wanting to go to treatment are pretty small. And really, we have had probably about 60% the last 2 years of folks who have entered some kind of treatment. And a lot of them have been through treatment many times before. I mean, I've got a guy who's been to treatment like 22 times. And one of the philosophies of our program is that it's not that you just don't give up on someone. And that the more you try it, the more likely it is to succeed. The treatment does succeed in the end. So we continue to attempt that. A lot of people become discouraged because the system is so hopeless. And generally, if you have support and if you have someone behind you, that may be what it takes to kind of sustain your effort this time around. You never know when someone's going to try.
So once you've found a client in an apartment, you continue seeing that person? You don't just drop them?
Yep.
Often that's where the work begins.
That's what I would think, too.
Yeah. I was on the street for... I worked with, and I still work with, and for the homeless. That young woman got me an apartment. Mm-hmm. And summertime, I don't cook at that many places. And I'm able to go back to it to keep me busy doing something. And that's the problem with a lot of homeless, is they've got nothing to do.
Right. I've worked with people with AIDS, and we have a program at San Francisco for housing people with AIDS, where a social worker will live right in the same building. Do you have anything like that?
There's a lot of the subsidized houses that have supportive services on site, and it's wonderful, and it does quite well in being able to maintain housing with a population that has had a hard time maintaining housing.
You know, their main job is making sure that these people get their meds and take them.
Mm-hmm. Not an easy job.
It's not an easy job at all. Similar, that might be what you're doing.
There's a couple of housing projects too, not through REACH, but that specifically serve people living with AIDS. There's not many, because I know their waiting lists are years long, but they have a couple in Seattle, and they're working to get more.
Eric is a housing expert.
Is your office right downtown? What street is your office at?
Well, we have one of our offices is where the sobering center is, and that's at Virginia and Bourne, and that's where we call our base at some points, but most of the time we're on the streets. And then we're also based at Evergreen Treatment Services too.
And those are all over? Evergreen Treatment Centers are all over the city, or is it just one?
There's just one. Evergreen's also a methadone program. So that was sort of their experience coming into this work, was that they had done harm reduction treatment for a long time, and they had a harm reduction as opposed to, which is different from an abstinence-based treatment philosophy. Abstinence-based meaning someone needs to stop using before they get services. And methadone basically is substituting a different, you know, form of an opiate and then helping people maintain and improve their lives on a different substance. So that's why Evergreen, that's why they have this, that's why they do it for them.
The two nurses that work with you, where do they work out of? Do they just work the streets too and have a bag with them and their supplies and
kinda
equipment?
They work out of the sobering center, the one that has the clinic. He's there in the mornings, mm-hmm. for people who are leaving the sobering center early in the mornings, and he asked them if they need any kind of work. And then the other part of their job is that they buddy up with us. And if we have a client who we think needs medical attention, we let them know, and then they go connect with that person. And we all walk around with backpacks full of the stuff that we need in it. Theirs has medical stuff in it. Ours has some charts, but basically just any informational stuff that we think a client will need at some point, you know. So that's how they do it.
And as much as we can be advocates in a hospital setting with another hospital social worker, they're just because of their medical field, they're able to look at a chart and see what else they need that we won't be able to, and they could be able to provide a different type of advocacy that we're unable to do.
Mm-hmm. I take it the individuals that came with you are part of the Reach 2?
Both, Reach 1 and Reach 2. Okay.
Because my understanding from what you were saying at the beginning was that they moved into activities. They were primarily in charge of activities beyond the region. I just thought this might be one of those activities.
Yeah, we have activities that people from Reach 1 come to also. Oh. Quite a few.
Are there any education programs for these people? Any training?
Yeah.
Do they use them?
Mm-hmm.
You did a cooking class recently.
Yeah. One of the classes I did, or activity I did a couple weeks ago, was cooking and trying to get people to eat their five, you know, fruits and vegetables a day. That was something. A lot of clients, one of your clients is going to school.
Going to computer school.
Yeah.
He was able to get funding to go into vocational school. So he had done training with roofing and just different sorts of air conditioning. He had a scale. He lost part of his legs, became homeless, and he's just getting back together, and was able to get into vocational school.
Those are existing things, and then you can feed them into an existing program.
Mm-hmm. Is that right? That's true. But this was a particular vocational school that we were able to get funding for. It wasn't our vocational school.
not a lot of our folks are probably going to work. Most people are pretty disabled. So we have like a lot of physical disabilities and some mental health, so.
Yeah, with this education on how to live.
Mm. Right, that's what I was wondering, if you're talking about like education for worker. You mean like life skills kinds of things?
Both or any.
George, I'm kind of interested in how SHARE works with REACH. You know, like if I'm really interested in these self-managed shelters. So if somebody has to be sober when they come to a shelter, I mean, how do you guys work together in terms of?
Well, I'm basically, I got their numbers, you know. And, I call them up, you know, somebody really comes to me, and that's another thing I've been well known for in Seattle, try to help people. You know, regardless, that's one reason I'm out here taking a vacation, because I can't in Seattle. I mean, you know, like I said, I'm a well-known cook. If I don't cook at one place, I'm in another place.
Oh, okay.
And I come out here, there's no phones. Nobody knows I'm here except the people that are here.
Yeah, well, the bad news is they want you to cook breakfast tomorrow.
Yes, that was going to tell you. Elected to do breakfast tomorrow.
Well, before we close, we'd like to introduce you to the people. Is Wayne here?
Wayne just left.
This is Gloria McKenzie. This is George. What's your last name, George?
Boulevard.
And this is Billy Olson. And if they have anything they want to say, feel free to say it now. Do you have anything you'd like to add to the process?
Anything important that we're missing? Or anything about yourself?
Oh, what do I do?
Do you want to say anything, Gloria? You don't have to.
Well, I'm glad I quit drinking, and I told Tracy I used to work in a post office a long time ago. She said, well, good, come down and do the change of addresses for us.
What a good idea.
So Gloria volunteers at the Compass Center an hour a day, or however long it takes
Friday.
You to finish.
Monday through Friday.
Yeah.
And I'm retired from Seattle Parks Department. A supervisor. Even when I was in the park department, I lived in the parks.
So these were people who were formerly homeless, and now they're very vital volunteers. I mean, Gloria, the Compass Center depends on her, and people depend on George for food. And so, you know, so that's something, that's a part of the, you know, the part of the REACH thing that we, one of the things that I feel proud about and that kind of gives me the strength to keep going is that when you can see that happen. So should that be it? Is that it?
Thank you. Well, very much. I was going to say, I could say the same about you.
What?
I'd say the same about you. You give me hope, too, for the work you guys do.
Oh,
yeah. Let me just say this, too, that we have a young man living in our house that somehow, he was homeless for the last 6 months, and our son brought him home. And he's living with us now, and we're trying to help him, and we need all the help we can get, so give me some suggestions.
Well, I would say hook up with a program, an organization, because I don't think individuals can do it.
No.
It's much too much to
so.
Be done to, you know, an individual can take a person there and, yeah. You know, that kind of thing, but I think it's much too much to be done for an individual, a couple, or whatever,
yeah.
Because the organization has the know-how, they have the staff there who are used to dealing with that, they have all the connections, and that's what you need.
Okay, welcome any kind of suggestions, hooking up with anybody in Minneapolis, any groups in Minneapolis that work with that, I appreciate that.
Okay, well grab me and I'll see what I can give you a number. In fact, you could talk to Kelly.
Kelly,
Chapman, yeah, you could ask him and he can probably give you the names of some places to
sure.
to go to connect.
Super, I'll ask him. Yeah.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.